On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lots of rockets flying this week all over America as Americans celebrated the 4th over Cape Canaveral as the space shuttle roared up once again, safe, we hope. Over the Middle East as Israel and the Palestinians took the gloves off, and briefly over the Pacific as North Korea test-fired a breed of rocket that could, one day, reach the USA with nuclear weapons. We'll look at the week this hour, at those fireworks and more, on immigration, big tobacco, Ken Lay, and murder rape charges against a U.S. trooper in Iraq. Up next, On Point, a week of rockets. We've got great interpreters with us this hour. From Washington, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. He's also creator and co-moderator with Fareed Zakaria of Post Global, an online dialogue about global issues. David Ignatius, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
From Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, just back from Iraq and Iran. She's author of Willful Blindness, the Bush Administration and Iraq. Trudy, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Trudy and David.
Trudy Rubin, first to you. What's your top story?
I'm fascinated by North Korea. If it wasn't serious, it would be humorous. You have Kim Jong-il basically beating his chest and saying, look at me, by firing these missiles. And this is a country that does have material for nuclear weapons that possibly could give it to terrorists. But the U.S. is downplaying this threat, saying it's not World War III and we must get back to multilateral negotiations. There's a lot of incredible ironies here.
John Bolton, U.S. ambassador at the U.N., saying, let's be calm, let's be deliberate.
I think it's important that we proceed in a careful fashion through this. The circumstance is obviously different when North Korea launches 7, at least, ballistic missiles.
Japan, a little closer to those missiles, pretty worried. Here's Japanese UN Ambassador Kenzo Oshima saying Tokyo has already imposed its own sanctions on North Korea.
Ban on the entry of North Korean ships into Japanese ports, and ban on travels of officials of North Korea to Japan.
Ban, says Japan there. Trudy Rubin, is the Bush administration succeeding, failing, treading water as these missile firings? I mean, they looked like duds, but still, sooner or later, they could work. Is George Bush going to leave a legacy of success or failure on this front?
I think they basically are treading water because, in fact, there is no military option. One of the problems is that early on, the President Bush did not want to negotiate with North Korea. It is an awful regime. It does terrible things to its own people. But the fact is, I think in the beginning, the administration thought that there were options, military options, isolation options that just didn't exist, and they've found that out now. So the question is how to get North Korea to be more realistic and get back to the table. But North Korea sees that, for example, we're now offering Iran the possibility of a light water reactor that we once offered them and then took back the offer after they misbehaved. So North Korea is trying to play for a better deal. In reality, they're not likely to use those missiles. The bigger danger is that they might give nuclear material to terrorists. I don't think that's likely either in the shorter medium run. But it's tough, and it will take tremendous diplomacy to get China and Russia to sort of take a tough turn. I think the Bush administration has a real problem with this, and they might indeed leave office with North Korea having far more nuclear material than it had when they came to office.
More effective diplomacy needed than we've seen so far. David Ignatius in Washington, what's at the top of your news list this week, sir?
Well, Tom, my story of the week is, I'm afraid, would be my story of the last several decades, which is the inability of the Israelis and the Palestinians to find a way to really move forward toward the two-state solution that for many, many years, I think people on both sides have wanted. We saw over the last week the capture of a young Israeli soldier by the Hamas forces in Gaza. We've now seen an intense Israeli reinvasion of northern Gaza. It's going to be very tough now for the Israelis to get back out. I really think that the whatever momentum there was after the Israeli unilateral disengagement from Gaza, the Olmert government's discussion of unilateral withdrawal from much of the West Bank, I really feel has been dissipated. And unfortunately, we're still locked in the situation where the two parties neither can negotiate and compromise, nor can they separate. They're just caught in this sort of impossible status quo they can't escape.
So the conflict is back, and it's bad. You know, David, we spent an hour talking about this week, and at the end of it, a kind of frustration. Like, what do you say? What does anybody do here? And behind that, the call for the U.S. to do something. Is the U.S. stepping up here in a way that's most effective or not? Because certainly U.S. interests are not helped by this thing coming back to a boil by blood in the streets again here.
No, it's important for the United States to make some progress on this issue. This really is something that inflames passions throughout the Middle East, really throughout the whole world. I think that this is a time when Americans should say, watching this tragic people being swallowed up by the past, in a sense, to say, we need to get involved. These people cannot solve this problem on their own. If ever there was a time for real U.S. mediation, or, you know, a kind of quartet, that is to say, the U.S. plus Europe plus the Soviet Union, in effect, or plus Russia, to get involved, this is it. We've seen what U.S. mediation can do in the past. It helped produce the breakthroughs with Egypt and with Jordan and some other Arab states. I think it's time for it to return.
David Ignatius, step back here for a second. This was supposed to be the era of U.S. hyperpower. And yet here we've got North Korea, you know, stepping its Taipodong rocket up on a launch pad for days and days, and the U.S. just kind of trying to get something done. Here we've got Israel and the Palestinians back at it, not solved. Here we've got the Iraq conflict going on. What about American power and all these problems, some of which could end up nuclear-tipped?
They could end up posing that kind of existential threat to the U.S., but they don't now. I think it's important to distinguish between the world of the Cold War, where, you know, we as kids, Trudy and I, went to bed worrying about nuclear war that could obliterate much of America, and the kinds of problems that we face now. They're serious. In a sense, you know, these are the problems of a post-Cold War world where the U.S. tried to be, thought it could be, the world's policeman, has gotten bogged down in many conflicts. I think North Korea is trying to you know, get the technology so that it can claim to pose a threat to the United States. Maybe Iran is trying to do the same thing, but both are a long way off. And my own feeling is that the North Koreans really have blundered badly in this missile firing. I mean, you know, they've organized a coalition of support for the U.S. against them, and they've shown that their missile technology is no good. Their rockets don't work. So, you know, I think there are many problems around the world. It is a scary time, but compared to other scary times that we've known, and I think we ought to be cautious in over-dramatizing this.
Jack Beatty, bring us home. You've been watching headlines a little closer to our turf here.
Well, the earmark scandal has taken another turn. Earmarks are the elements put into bills without any debate for projects in congressmen's districts. They were $19 billion in 1996. This year, $64 billion, 12,000 earmarks in this fiscal year.
And this is the spending that nobody has a break on. Right. It just goes in. Nobody even knows what's happening very often before the vote's over.
That's right. And, you know, we really have this earmarking has led to really three different kinds of graft. There's graft pure. We see that with Duke Cunningham. In exchange for earmarks, he got cash. Bob Ney is being investigated, another Republican chairman. Jerry Lewis is being investigated on that front, another Republican chairman. We've also seen graft as campaign contributions. Mm. That's just the way things are done. You get a contract for a company in your district. The company then gives you campaign money. The New York Times did a front page story on Harold Rogers, Republican chairman from Kentucky. Kentucky. This is how he does business. He gets earmarks. The companies give him back the money. Jim Moran, Democrat in Virginia, he gave to got money for a company in his district. They gave him $20,000.
And there sits the deficit, bigger and bigger and bigger.
There. And now we have a third category, and that category is what's called honest graft. David Wellner revived that this week in talking about it. Honest graft is the term given by George Washington Plunkett, a sachem of Tammany Hall. And honest graft, as he explained, is this. He's in tight with Tammany Hall. He knows where the subway is going to run. Before that contract is announced, he buys up land there and then sells it to the city at a nice profit. He said, "I seen my opportunities and I took them." That's honest graft.
Jim's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello. My comment would be I'm concerned that the Korean situation frames up and really illustrates the military weakness that we now have in the United States because of the Iraq War. It's obvious that all of our resources have been used up. We're even having to have military bases, as I understand, that can't pay their utility bills. And it's obvious that we have no military capabilities in any other direction. And I think the world has got to understand that, and it leaves us in a terrible predicament, in something that we might really need military power, and we've wasted it in Iraq. And I think it just really frames up the poor decision-making of the Bush administration.
Jim, let us look at that, the kind of paper tiger concern here that the U.S. doesn't have teeth anymore, maybe when it needs them, on the Korean Peninsula. Trudy Rubin, how about it? Are there real military options here in any case? And does the U.S. have one hand or more tied behind its back?
There's no question that our involvement in Iraq and the mess there gives the perception in the world that we're tied down and we're a paper tiger. In reality, the Korean issue never had a military solution. That was a fallacy from the beginning. It was also a fallacy that the administration thought that regime was likely to collapse from within if it was squeezed from without. Mm. What the Bush administration didn't realize is that neither South Korea nor China wants North Korea to collapse. The Chinese are afraid of a huge refugee outflow. The South Koreans the same, and they know how much it costs Germany to rebuild East Germany, and they don't want to pay that. It would be much worse with the North. So Bush policy, I think, was based on wrong premises at the beginning. There really only is a negotiated solution. If we, for example, bombed their missile site, they could retaliate by raining conventional weapons on Seoul, which is only about 30 miles away, the South Korean capital, and with conventional weapons destroy that city before we could retaliate. So it has to be negotiated. I think we started late in the game with negotiations and delayed any direct contacts between us and the North Koreans, which we have offered now in the context of six-party talks, but late in the day. So North Korea was always going to be difficult to deal with. But I think that for the first term, the Bush administration got off on the wrong foot, and now there is no alternative but negotiations.
David Ignatius, how about it, to Jim's concern out of Nashville, that the U.S. just has fewer options realistically at its fingertips today because of the huge commitment in Iraq? And then what about North Korea? You point out that the missile is effectively practically just toppled over. Nevertheless, every test it marks an advance in understanding. North Korea is working on its missilery. The CIA says they've got nuclear weapons capacity. What about the U.S. military power being strapped? Does that factor in here? And B, in any case, how do we move forward here if China doesn't put the screws on?
Well, if you talk to uniformed military officers in Iraq at the Pentagon here in Washington, where I am, you do hear a real concern that the military, especially the U.S. Army, is stretched to the breaking point. They think that the rosy numbers that you see about reenlistment rates and other things that imply that there is not a crisis in the military basically are painting a false picture, that it's badly overstretched, that it leaves us unable to deal aggressively with other threats. Certainly there's a sense that the Iranians view us as pinned down in Iraq and unable to mount a serious military challenge to Iran. I think on the question of how the U.S. will deal militarily with the North Korean threat, while Trudy is absolutely right that that in the medium term, some kind of diplomatic engagement with Korea is the only response. I'm sure that these missile launchings and the others that may follow are going to reinvigorate U.S. efforts to come up with a workable missile defense system. And I have a feeling that there will be a broader consensus of support in the U.S. for that than there's been in the past.
Well, are you saying by that, David, that we cannot stop the North Korean program, so our only hope is to go back to the idea, the dream, whatever it is, of the Star Wars defense umbrella?
I think it's conceivable that you could have a kind of broad engagement with North Korea that would freeze its missile program. I think the North Koreans are so reluctant to give up their bargaining chips that I can't predict how that's going to go. But I think regardless of how it goes, the desire to move from a basically impractical and unworkable missile defense system to something that does provide more defense against the rogue states that do seem intent on getting the kind of missile technology that could threaten the United States, I think that's going to grow and grow.
Trudy, I hear you there. Yes, Trudy.
Can I come back in just on one point here? Mm-hmm. The caller, I think, was absolutely right that the bog down in Iraq does have all kinds of repercussions. And David put his finger on a key one. I just was in Iran at the latter part of May. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that the Iranians feel overconfident because they feel the U.S. is bogged down and they feel that they have been immensely strengthened by that. The U.S. took out their two major enemies, the Taliban and Saddam, and yet we are militarily bogged down. It makes it much more difficult for us to pose any direct kind of threat to them, although in the back of their minds is the possibility that Bush might bomb their nuclear sites. But in reality, they see us as much weakened by Iraq. And there's one other factor that I think is crucial here. I think our involvement in Iraq and the huge amount of attention that the administration has to pay there has kept us from the kind of focus on Gaza and Israel and the Palestinians that needs to be there. And I think it is crucial that we come back to that focus, because what you see now in Gaza is essentially anarchy. This thing is drifting out of control, and that is not in the interest of Israelis and their security or of the Palestinians or of us. And it's terrible on Al Jazeera besides. But security-wise, it's very risky. And Iraq is keeping us, I believe, from the focus on that issue that should be there.
Jack Beatty, how about it? Security has been the big word of this administration. Now, just today, we've got this news of an alleged plot to bomb New York's Holland Tunnel, and Lebanon confirming that it's arrested a suspect. New York Daily News writing about it. Confirmation seems to be coming. I'm not sure where the U.S. government stands at this point, but here it is, not in North Korea or in Iraq, but the allegation anyway, right there on the entry to Manhattan.
Yes, and Foreign Policy magazine has a poll of scores of national security experts, some from Republican administrations, some from Democrats, grading U.S. performance in the war against terror. And 82% pretty much fail what we're doing. That's the score. That by 82%, these 100-odd people, I don't know if they're 100, but there are lots of them, say we're failing. We're not doing the right thing. And one of the things, of course, we're doing wrong is we've made threats now against these states. We've talked about regime change and the axis of evil. So you talk tough and you make regimes think, boy, the only way to keep this country from toppling our regime is to get a nuclear weapon fast. So, their efforts in both Iran and North Korea were accelerated clearly in response to the Bush threat. But we have no way of countering that, the result of that, which is a buildup in both countries. And, it brings us back to then the possibility of leakage from those countries to terrorists. And can't blink that at all, which is a much liver prospect, really, than the fantasy leakage of the non-weapons from Iraq. So the administration's substitute reality here, Iraq, for the real world, has really cost the United States. And we probably are going to finish this administration with a nuclear-armed North Korea with capability to reach this country. However, you know, the administration people apparently have concluded that Kim is deterrable. He's not a madman. If he even gets these weapons, he understands that if he uses them, everything will be destroyed there.
But a lot will be destroyed across the border, too.
That
I mean,
is
if you bring on, you know, the sort of end game, there's South Korea, there's Japan. Jack, I want to look at a very real reality that London is remembering this week. Of course, it was 1 year ago today that we had the bombings there, and the weird development this week that we had, today was the anniversary, yesterday, this video featuring one of the bombers, apparently taped before the bombing last year, aired on Al Jazeera television. This was Shahzad Tanweer, among those who killed seven people on a train at the Aldgate station during the attacks on July 7th last year. Here he is saying that the London attack was only the beginning.
What you have witnessed now is only the beginning of a string of attacks that will continue and become stronger until you pull your forces out of Afghanistan and Iraq and until you stop your financial and military support to America and Israel.
There, a voice from the grave of one of the London bombers from a year ago, just out on video this week, more forethought somehow than we might have imagined. John is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hey, this is a great show. I really appreciate it. I think the story has to be that, you know, we're the great supposed moral authority in the world, and we've destroyed, you know, many more than 100,000 innocent people, basically, when, you know, this administration would really prefer that it be a dictatorship that they know best on behalf of all of us, it's so dangerous, I can't even calculate where we're going with this. I mean, I don't think anybody can, but it scares the heck out of me, I know that. And I wish, you know, that we could get back our moral authority, whatever we had before the Bush administration took over. And I think that has to be the biggest story that it's certainly in my lifetime.
The look for that authority, the search for it, maybe as much as the military power. David Ignatius, you're kind of our even keel voice here today. I mean, Bush has been up against it on a number of fronts. Whenever he goes out into the world, lots of criticism out there. Guantanamo, he's taken a lot of heat on. John says moral authority comes number one. Is the White House thinking along those same lines, that they've got to somehow scratch that back to confront these issues?
Well, one thing that I do see here in Washington is at least a recognition that the U.S. is isolated, is pinned down, is very unpopular in the world, has lost a lot of its moral authority. And there's a recognition that something needs to be done from a national security standpoint, first of all, to address this problem. And there's several things that I see happening. First, on the subjects that we've been talking about, North Korea and the North Korean missiles, to some extent on Iraq and certainly on Iran, the heart of administration policy has been to keep a coalition of allies together. Not to be seen to be acting alone, not to respond. I mean, it's obvious that Kim Jong-il would love to go tete-a-tete with George Bush, and Bush is not really giving him that opportunity. He's not responding directly. There's a very low-key response. There's a talk about the six-party talks.
Yep.
The same thing with Iran. There's an attempt to keep a coalition together that's as broad as possible that includes Russia and China. So, I mean, I would say to the caller, I think the administration at least has learned that lesson after Iraq, that going it alone doesn't work. It's dangerous. On the question of Guantanamo, what I've picked up in the last week, which is really interesting to me, is that after the Supreme Court's decision in the Hamdan case, which was a sharp rebuff for the administration's whole strategy of holding and interrogating terrorist suspects, at Guantanamo Bay, there is an effort to rethink that, to ask, could we work with allies around the world to draft some new rules that everybody would accept that would allow us to close Guantanamo, this symbol of everything the world hates about the United States, and in a sense, you know, make a new beginning.
What kind of rules, David? What would help? How would a rule change in what? The Geneva Convention you're talking about? Would that let Guantanamo stay open?
The discussion, Tom, the discussion that's been invited by some of key Europeans is whether we should revisit the Geneva Conventions in light of the problems posed by stateless terrorist suspects, the kind of people like al-Qaeda who are operating across borders, how do you deal with that challenge? And it's argued that the traditional laws of war really don't work very well. So there's a desire to look at what's known as Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions and maybe revise it. That proposal was made by John Reid, the former British Defense Secretary. To my surprise, many prominent Europeans over the last month have said they would support such an effort.
But revise it in such a way as to let Guantanamo go on or to let it be shut down?
No, probably Guantanamo would shut down, but you'd need rules. I mean, something has to replace Guantanamo. There's an understanding that there's some very dangerous people there, that other dangerous people are going to be captured. You know, this war isn't going to stop. People who want to bomb London subways aren't going to disappear. So what do you do? And there's been quite a lot of discussion beneath the surface, you know, between Americans and people, especially in Europe. And I'm told that right now, this week, the White House is trying to think, should we embark on some broad effort to engage the Europeans in rewriting the rules and as a preliminary to shutting down Guantanamo?
There's a potential move here. Let's take a call from Charleston, South Carolina. William is on the line. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
First of all, let me say I agree with Ms. Rubin. I think she's dead on with the issue with Gaza and Israel. But let me go to Mr. Ignatius. He said something about, for that area, mediation would be the process to go through, as we had, I think, in 1981, between Menachem Begin and Sadat, which, of course, led to the peace accords and all that. Then, however, the mediation further led to the angering of the extremists and, of course, the death of Sadat. So I'm not sure that that necessarily will work.
So what's the answer?
The answer is to somehow get rid of the extremists. I mean, I think they're almost automatons by now. They're so programmed. I mean, many of them have been in madrasas and have been literally programmed for over a decade.
But how do you do that? You've got a million-plus people in Gaza. A lot of them this week, whether or not they support the capture of this Israeli soldier, you know, they're seeing the Israeli overflights and the bombing of bridges and all the rest. Meanwhile, Israelis are seeing the tunnels come out of Gaza, rockets flying into Israel. How do you?
Can I come into it here,
confusing,
Tom?
Very complicated issues that will not be resolved very readily because it is so terribly complicated and so protracted in terms of how long it's been going on.
We're looking this hour at the news of the week with Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, and Jack Beatty's here. Big story this week, the death of Ken Lay, 64 years old, convicted founder of Enron, awaiting sentencing, possibly life behind bars, died, we're told, of a heart attack in Aspen, Colorado on Wednesday. Here's what former Enron employee Tammy Hutmacher said about the death of her former boss.
I think he got his justice. And you know what? We don't have to sit and support him, and you know, we don't have to pay for another trial. We don't have to pay for him sitting in jail and watching cable TV and having luxuries.
Wow, that's rough from the former Enron employee. Ken Lay, after all, is a father and grandfather, but dead now. David's calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're good.
Thanks for letting me in.
Sure.
What struck me about Ken Lay was how convenient his death was. And I wonder if anybody in the prosecution area that got him convicted is really going to get a DNA sample to make sure they're really putting him in the ground. I know that's an awful gruesome thing to say to his family because I'm sure he's really loved. But if, you know, this guy was one of the biggest swindlers in business, he's probably got money stashed all over the planet, you know, and it just kind of crossed my mind that, darn, this sure was inconvenient, you know, for this to happen.
You and about 300 million other people and no doubt a lot of CEOs, David. Trudy, what about it? This thought, you know, floated across a lot of minds. And then there's this. Since he died before his appeal has been heard, I read that he may never have a criminal record, that the $43 million in assets that he held may not be taken by the government, may stay with his family. What do you make of the Ken Lay story, Trudy?
Well, if one were a religious person, you could say that this was some kind of divine justice. But apparently there have been medical investigations that say that he really did have severe heart problems. Perhaps he was unaware of them, but that this apparently was a death of natural causes. The other thing is that from what I have read, the liens against his property by debt, by creditors, will eat up most of what remains of his estate. And the huge bulk of his estate in the hundreds of millions went down with Enron because it was mostly invested in Enron stock. So
right.
There is some justice there. and his family will get his life insurance. So the question for me is, does this really send the message to other executives that it should? Because the most important thing is lessons learned.
David Ignatius, how about it for the country? Here's the son of a Baptist minister, small-town Missouri boy, ended up heading, the seventh largest corporation in the country for a while, and then it all fell down. And now this untimely death, do you think the message has gone out? Does it change the kind of expectations, standards of American business?
Well, this has been a national morality play running now for some years since the collapse of Enron. I found Ken Lay a pathetic figure through this. I think the idea that he was the criminal mastermind here is wrong. As I read the evidence in the trial, he was somebody who, like many modern CEOs, really was not fully on top of his company. He didn't understand all the transactions it was doing. He didn't bother to inform himself. It's clear that he lied on some key occasions. But the real financial shenanigans going on underneath them were things that in some cases he didn't really get. I think that the lesson
should have represented him in court, David.
Well, I don't know about that. He could have used a better lawyer. That was his legal defense was a disaster. But you know, I think that American business is different after the Enron scandal. But you know, the fundamental reality is that people who make large amounts of money almost always are over some kind of line or another, and the question is whether we're detecting, you know, the line that they've crossed. I mean, when I talk to people in business who made great fortunes, they almost always will say, you know, they were doing things that were not technically illegal, but that were obvious. I mean, how do you make a great fortune if not by doing something that nobody else is doing?
Well, let's hope it's not always illegal. But there goes Ken Lay. Jack, I hear you.
Yeah, but you know, in Ken Lay's case, that film, The Smartest Guys in the Room,
documentary
shows,
about Enron,
shows Lay addressing his employees and telling them, listen, this is, I think, as late as September 2001. The company is failing. He has been selling scores of millions in Enron stock. And he looks at these people and he says, listen, this is a good thing. Don't give up on buying our stock. It is a great investment. Keep going. I see that as heinous. You know, that's as immoral. That's, if that doesn't define corporate sin, looking at your employees and in order to get them not to lose faith, say, invest in this company, even as you are selling your stock because you know the thing is failing. What a scoundrel. You know, George Bush's comment on this wasn't quite medically advised. He said, quote, his heart was with the Lord, but apparently it was wrong with his blood.
Wrong with his blood. I'm not sure what med school that comes from, but that's more than I'm going to solve it. Rachel's calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Rachel. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a couple of comments about the story about the Stephen Green, the Army private who's accused of rape and murder.
In Iraq, yes.
Yeah. My husband's in the military, and my dad, uncles served as Marines in Vietnam. And I have a real love and respect for our military, and this case and then all of the others that have come to light in, you know, recent month or so are really weighing very heavily on my heart.
And what do you make of them, Rachel? I mean, this one's another terrible story. So how does it hit you from a real military family?
Well, you know, it seems to me that at least in our community, which is, you know, I live right near the Air Force base, so you know, very militarized community, but it doesn't seem like that a lot of Americans are losing faith in our military, but, you know, I just wonder what is going on over there, and why does it seem to be a real spate in, you know, past year, let's say, And were there not incidences earlier? You know, is there something really taking a toll on our soldiers?
It is very troubling and maybe disastrous for American policy and image there. I want to listen to a couple of clips right out of that region. Rachel, thanks for your call from Sumter. But let's listen here to Iraq's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, calling for an independent Iraqi investigation of this case.
We believe that the immunity given to members of the international forces is what emboldened them to commit such crimes in cold blood. This requires that such immunity should be reconsidered. We say we should be involved in investigating the crimes committed against Iraqis.
And they were some crimes. 21-year-old Army Private Stephen Green, he's been discharged since from the Army for antisocial personality disorder. Arraigned on rape and murder charges this week, shooting a mother and father and a daughter, and then and raping another daughter and killing that girl and burning the bodies. U.S. military spokesman Major General William Caldwell, here he is saying the Iraqi government and people will be kept informed during the various criminal investigations.
We're going to be transparent as we can. We're going to continue dialogue with the government of Iraq, with the people of Iraq, and make sure that everybody sees the process as it goes through. And if, in fact, they find that these people, in fact, committed those crimes, they will be held fully accountable.
Murder and rape, as bad as it gets for that family, certainly, and for the U.S. image. Trudy, you've been there. You hear Rachel's family history and her concern. What do you make of this case, the spate of cases, as she says?
I was just in Iraq for the first 2 weeks in June. And first, let me say that when you have a military fighting this kind of war and you have soldiers going back for their third and fourth tour, you have overstretched reserves who have done two tours. This is ordinary civilians who may have spent 2 years out of the last five there.
Yeah, but rape, that's not triggered.
No,
that's
no, no,
more
no. I am not justifying at all. What I'm saying is you have to be aware, both on the military and on the civilian side, of the danger of problems like this. Now, there have been many problems like this, and it is only now when such heinous crimes come to light. And this one came to light almost by accident after two soldiers in the same unit were captured, kidnapped, and mutilated and killed. And that's only when it came to light because a soldier talked to a therapist about the previous incident. There have been many incidents. I don't know if incidents of this heinous nature, but many, many incidents of Iraqi civilians being killed that never come to light. My translator, a young Iraqi doctor named Yasser Salhi, who was also becoming a fine journalist and worked for Knight Ridder, was shot through the head when he was driving home from the barbers on a street where there was no roadblock, and there were U.S. snipers at the end of the street, but they didn't block it off. And that incident would never have come to light. The military denied that it had happened unless Knight Ridder had done an investigation. And his family, which was very pro-American, has some of his relatives have become, you know, extremely angry, needless to say, about this. And it happens over and over again. Many Iraqi officials I know have relatives who were killed. Now, this is something the military has to pay attention to. And there actually was an investigation after an Italian intelligence agent was killed accidentally by American troops when he had just rescued an Italian journalist hostage. The Pentagon came up with new, better rules for dealing with civilians, and they weren't implemented. Now, perhaps they will be. The civilian thing is a real problem, and it will really continue to aggravate Iraqis. And this is forcing it to come to light and be confronted. It should have been confronted earlier.
David Ignatius, this Army private discharged for antisocial personality disorder, and yet he was there in Iraq. Is this another sign that they're scraping for troops, that they're putting the wrong people at the front, as it were?
Well, there certainly is concern that has happened during the Vietnam War to make enlistment quotas. They are having to lower the standards for admission. That happened in the later years of the Vietnam War, and there has been, I am told, some reduction in the standards for enlistment now. The one point I would note, I think what Trudy said is absolutely right. I think it's interesting and important to see the new Iraqi government under Prime Minister Maliki step up and express its outrage and demand to be part of the process of investigating and ultimately, I would suspect, punishing people who've done these things. I mean, you know,
Maliki, are you suggesting this U.S.
amnesty,
soldier might be given to the Iraqi government for justice?
I don't think the U.S. soldier will be given to the Iraqi government, but you note that Maliki is saying in his comments that the amnesty, the sort of general exemption from Iraqi law that has been given to the U.S. and the coalition forces, will not be tenable if incidents like this continue. And what I see in this is an assertion of Iraqi sovereignty by this new prime minister, saying, you know, we are a country. We will not stand for these outrageous actions, even by our allies. I mean, after all, it's the U.S. who's keeping Maliki alive in the green zone. Mm. And I think there's an understanding in the U.S. military that, in fact, the more Iraqis speak out, you know, and express sovereignty, the better from the U.S. standpoint, because it means maybe there'll be a real country down the road in another year or two.
Mm-hmm. A silver lining in a dark glass there. Tom's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Thank you. Great show today. I believe that the biggest story is America's loss of moral authority just with anybody. If you set a standard and then don't follow that standard, you lose your moral authority. And I think possibly we could regain moral authority by entering into the International Criminal Court Agreement and turning over not only the Guantanamo Bay people to that, but also our soldiers who rape and murder people in Iraq.
But this is just the kind of situation, I think, that the U.S. doesn't want to be in the International Criminal Court because they don't want to see U.S. soldiers or officers brought up on charges there. Tom, we got it from Des Moines, and thanks very much for your call. Let's get one more from Franklin, Tennessee. Alex is on the line. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In my perspective, the biggest story it is that America is changing, and it's not the same America that I migrated to some 27 years ago. By choice and legally, it's not the same. I'm almost afraid to say I'm American if I travel overseas and say, because of the stigma now that we have associated. I heard at one time that America was founded on Christian values or this or that. I think it's America was founded on humane values, on humane principles. That's why people migrated from all over the world to this wonderful land.
But here the country finds itself in a tough world. The government says, look, we're doing what it takes to fight back and fight for our security. You're saying that's not the way, Alex?
I don't think so. Look at today, and if you want to take a scorecard of America against our friends, do we have more friends today or do we have more enemies today versus, say, 4 or 5 years ago? And if you want to go even back 20 years ago at the era of the Cold War era. So I think we have created more enemies with our style of defense, if you would, than sometimes you catch more flies with honey. And
we hear it. 27 years since your immigration and questions there. Trudy, what's your calculus on this more or fewer friends math?
I think that there are a couple of crucial lessons here which I hope are finally beginning to penetrate the administration. One is that you cannot promote democracy and claim that you are going to bring democracy all over the world and then not be living by the same values that you are telling other people elsewhere that you are uniquely suited to bring around the world. You have to practice what you preach, and there has been a big disconnect. The second is, if you're going to fight a long-running battle against terrorists, long-running, I emphasize, you have to understand that it cannot be won by military alone. I'm not one of these people who don't say that there's a crucial military dimension, but you have to calculate the other piece of it. And the other piece of it, again, is not only do you have to indicate to the world that you haven't given up those values you're preaching. But at home, if this is long-running, you have to constantly weigh the balance between military and fighting terrorism and preserving values. I think that's what the court decision of Hamdan was about.
David Ignatius, we're right up against it. In a word, do you think the Bush administration is taking some of this on board, moving in this direction toward addressing these concerns?
I think that they've learned some lessons. I think the administration is still split. I think that they understand they're in deep trouble and they're not sure how to get out of it.
David Ignatius with The Washington Post, great to have you with us. And Trudy Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer, thanks to you both. Jack Beattie, good as always to have you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.